Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for today's call, examining the laws and policies that contribute to unnecessary police use of force against people of color and the reforms that can address this national crisis. My name is Christopher DeRocher, and I'm a Director of Policy Development Programming here at ACS. For those of you who may not know, ACS is a national network of progressive lawyers, judges, policymakers, academics, and law students who believe that the law should be a force to improve the lives of all people. ACS works for positive change by shaping debate on vitally important legal and constitutional questions, including issues at the intersection of race and the criminal justice system, such as those we will discuss today. Before we begin, I have a few housekeeping notes. Today's call is eligible for CLE credit. Instructions for claiming the CLE credit will be included in a follow-up email that we'll send to all attendees after the call. Currently, all callers' lines are muted. After the presentation, the operator will provide instructions for getting into the queue for asking questions. Also, I should note that this call is being recorded and will be available on our website shortly after it is over. I'd also like to remind folks that ACS is a nonpartisan organization, and as such, we neither endorse nor oppose candidates for public office. Any views our speakers might express about candidates during our conversation today are their own and do not reflect the position held by ACS. So over the past few years, the reality that people of color face a far greater, potentially fatal danger in their interactions with police has complicated the comforting narrative of post-civil rights equality that many Americans had accepted as true. While there are many angles from which to examine these problems, it is clear that our criminal justice policies play a role in creating many of these racial disparities. The implicit bias of the actors within that system, combined with the over-policing of communities of color and the absence of effective ways to hold law enforcement accountable, are helping to lead to the unnecessary deaths of black men and women at the hands of law enforcement. This raises a lot of questions. What legal and structural frameworks exist that lead to unnecessary police use of force against people of color? Relatedly, what legal and structural reforms are necessary to reset the framework within which police operate? How can we keep people safe from police excessive force while ensuring that the police can do their jobs? We're very lucky to have with us today two people who can help us to answer these questions and better understand the role that law and policy play in creating the dynamic between police and communities of color that too often result in police use of force, and the role that law and policy can play in addressing this crisis. Professor Cami Chavis is Professor of Law and Director of Criminal Justice Program at Wake Forest University School of Law. Among her experience prior to academia, Professor Chavis was most notably, for the purposes of this call, an Assistant United States Attorney in the District of Columbia. Professor Tracy Mears is the Walton Hale Hamilton Professor of Law at Yale Law School. She was previously the Max Pam Professor of Law and Director of the Center for Studies in Criminal Justice at the University of Chicago School of Law. In December 2014, President Obama named her as a member of his Task Force on 21st Century Policing. I'd now like to turn it over to Professor Chavis. Professor, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. And I think I'm just going to start my remarks by kind of detailing the legal framework when we're thinking about police use of force, particularly the lethal use of force. And I have to say that I'm speaking to you from Winston-Salem, North Carolina, which is about an hour and a half from Charlotte, North Carolina. And the events of last week are still fresh in my mind, and also probably for many of you. So I'm going to frame, I think it would be helpful if I kind of frame my remarks just through the lens of looking at Charlotte and possibly analyzing what happened there as best we can, because of course there's incomplete information, but I'll just use that as a frame. So one of the things when we're thinking about whether or not police officers can use any force in terms of effectuating seizures, that is, of course, analyzed under the Fourth Amendment, and it's an objectively reasonable standard. There was a case, Tennessee versus Garner, however, that set forth when officers could use deadly force. And Tennessee versus Garner, the facts of this case, their police officers had been called. It was nighttime. It had been called to what they thought was a burglary. They see a man, boy, running away, and the police officer gave chase, but then he shot the person, Garner, in the back of the head. So the question for the court was whether or not, and the officer was arguing that he acted in accordance with a Tennessee statute at the time that said you could use deadly force to subdue a fleeing felon. So the court had to decide whether or not apprehension by use of deadly force, whether or not it was subject to the Fourth Amendment's reasonableness requirement. So the court decided in that case that deadly force could not be used unless it's necessary to prevent the escape of that potential fleeing felon, and that the officer has probable cause to believe that the suspect posed a significant threat of death or serious physical injury to the officer or others. So in this case, Tennessee versus Garner, the court said that particular statute was deemed unconstitutional. The fact that this was an unarmed suspect that had allegedly broken into a dwelling at night did not automatically mean he was dangerous. And so this is particularly, I think, when we're thinking about the uses of force, and it's relevant because we've seen so many unarmed citizens where police officers are using deadly force. We have to begin to call that into question. If the suspect threatens the officer with a weapon, or if there was probable cause to believe that the suspect had committed a crime involving the infliction or threatened infliction of serious physical harm, then deadly force could be used if necessary to prevent the escape. Also, the court said, if feasible, though, some warning should be given. And the perceived danger did not have to be an actual danger, but could be an apparent danger. So I think this case is important because it gives us a number of different things to look at here, particularly when we're looking at the use of deadly force against so many unarmed citizens, and then it can even be helpful, I think, when we're thinking about citizens who may be armed. Another case that's relevant here, and then I'll, after I discuss Graham versus Connor, can maybe go through some of the facts of what we know, what's happened in Charlotte. So Graham versus Connor, and this actually happened in Charlotte, North Carolina. The police officers, they see some strange behavior being exhibited by a suspect, and he's walking back and forth into a convenience store. And they didn't know this at the time, but really he was having he was a diabetic, and he was having a reaction and needed insulin. Police officers, they stop him. They throw him against the car. He sustains lots of different injuries, facial injuries, very serious injuries during this encounter. And then they later find out that he has nothing. There's no criminal activity afoot. And so in this case, the court was trying to determine whether or not the force that was used to effect this seizure was reasonable under the Fourth Amendment. And the court says, in order to make this determination, we're going to look to the totality of circumstances. It's going to be on a case-by-case basis, and there are a number of different factors to include. So what's the severity of the crime at issue is one of the factors. Whether or not the suspect poses an immediate threat to the safety of officers or others is another factor. And then whether or not the suspect is actively resisting arrest or attempting to evade arrest by flight. And so reasonableness in this situation is judged from the perspective of a reasonable officer on the scene. Now, in North Carolina, and so there have been a lot of cases that have said, well, when is this timing? What timing is appropriate? What are we thinking about the timing of this objective reasonableness? And in North Carolina, those factors are in the North Carolina case law has shown that an officer's perception in light of the particular circumstances, the amount of force necessary is judged from the perspective of a reasonable officer on the scene without retrospective analysis. And so what this means is that officers are typically insulated from good faith mistakes. And in North Carolina, where you have a use of force continuum, it can be helpful to guide officers into what type of force is appropriate under what circumstances, but deviating from a departmental policy is not necessarily unreasonable. So that that legal framework that we have essentially, I think, is fraught with some difficulties in terms of when we're trying to decide whether or not force was appropriate in certain circumstances. What we know about the case with Mr. Scott in Charlotte, and of course, and I'll be happy to talk about this in the Q&A, the body camera footage, the lack of body camera footage, the resistance to releasing that body camera footage, but we have some depictions. It's inconclusive as to whether or not he was holding a weapon at the time. And you can see from this legal framework that that's really important. It's really crucial because why were the officers on the scene? They were not called to the scene because he was posing some problem. The officers in this case, they were there for an entirely different reason, to serve a warrant on someone else. So if we're looking at those Graham v. Connor factors and whether or not force was objectively reasonable, they're not called to the crime scene for any issue related to him. Whether the suspect poses an immediate threat to the safety of officers, well, of course, North Carolina, and I've mentioned this, North Carolina happens to be an open carry state, meaning that there are lots of citizens who may be at any time armed with a weapon. And so for me, the question is, how is that going to impact an officer's objective reasonableness? You don't know at any given time whether or not a suspect, if they're not threatening an officer with a gun, you don't know whether or not they have the legal right to carry that. And I don't think that the standard would give anyone the license to kill all of the potentially armed folks. So when we're looking at this legal framework, I think it's not taking into account implicit bias, which is something that we need to talk about. And finally, it would be important if Mr. Scott was holding that weapon, and that's what we don't know from the body camera footage. We can have the accounts of the officers. There was a gun found at the scene, but what was he doing with that gun? And that's what's so important. And if he was, of course, threatening the officers, then that, under this legal standard, would give the officers the justification to use deadly force. We can have a conversation, and I think that we'll begin talking about this in some of the later comments, of whether or not even in that situation, should less than lethal force be an option? Should it be the first option? Is lethal force the only option? It seems that currently under our law, as long as you're justified in using the deadly force, then you don't have to resort to any other less than lethal force. So it seems to me that some of these problems that we are that we're seeing with communities of color, the legal doctrines that we currently have are not going to solve them, but we can perhaps think about solving them through departmental policies and other administrative regulations. And with that, I'll let Tracy take over.
Okay, I'm here. Sorry about that. I'm actually on an Amtrak train from New York, and I'll be arriving in Metro Park shortly. Cammie, are you actually still on the line?
Yes, I'm here. Can
okay,
you hear me?
Great. Yes, because I need you to be my barometer for how hard and difficult it is for people to hear me. You know, I seems like it's okay, but I can't
yes,
tell.
Yes, you're fine.
So,
yes.
So if it's loud, then please intervene and let me let me know. I'll be off this train shortly. Okay, so you have just gotten a really good and detailed outline from Cammie about the constitutional law of force in police encounters, as well as some ideas about potential areas where law can intervene to create policy. So New York, North Carolina is a state, I assume, that has a use of force continuum that's articulated by state statute, and lots of states can do that. What I want to do is go up a bit and talk about the extent to which we might not need to rely so heavily on the problematics of the law as Cammie has described it. So one way of understanding reform is to say Graham versus Connor is extremely problematic, or the court didn't do a good enough job in Tennessee versus Garner in figuring out exactly when it is police could use lethal force. Another way of understanding it is to actually look at American policing itself and figure out the ways in which we decide what police are for and what kinds of tasks they should be engaged in. And I think when we take a look at that, we understand that the common thread in many of these incidents that we have seen, unfortunately, too often in social media is not any particular characteristic of the officers themselves, you know, not even necessarily their training, although I will have something to say about that momentarily, but instead is about how we understand the narrative policing of policing. And that narrative is one that emphasizes public safety and to the exclusion of the security of citizens. And by security, I mean we as citizens don't simply to desire to be safe from private predation, but instead what we also care about is being safe from government overreach, right? We care about both of these things. And in a world in which public safety that focuses on private predation is the dominant narrative, what you have is a kind of policing that justifies crime reduction as its own warrant. And that's a problem, right? Because crime reduction is not self-justifying. But if in a world in which police officers think that it is, we have settled into a world of aggressive policing, aggressive and proactive policing, where policing agencies think it's legitimate to heavily police very low-level infractions for the purpose of crime reduction. And that is why, I think, we see so many instances in which folks with broken taillights or people selling loose cigarettes and so on and so forth are in a situation in which some form of aggressive policing could even result. So I think that's the first question we should be taking seriously. Why is it that that is the form of policing that we have decided is the one we ought to promote? It is a form of policing, I think, that follows naturally from, and this is my own opinion, not the ACS's, Trump's call in the debate on Monday for law and order policing. It follows from that. That's problematic. So there's a question about how to change that. I feel like it's getting really loud, Cammie. Am I still okay?
Yes, you're good.
Okay. How do we change that? Well, instead of having a narrative policing that focuses on public safety, I said, I think we should have one that focuses on public security, and that requires a different orientation for law enforcement. So my own research has focused on the social psychology of legitimacy as a primary understanding for the appropriate role of legal authorities. And that research suggests that the public is much more likely to put trust in legal authority, whether that authority is a police officer, prosecutor, or judge, or even a teacher or social security worker, when that member of the public feels that the legal authority is legitimate. Four things seem to matter a lot. The extent to which a member of the public has an opportunity to participate in policymaking or in a particular encounter, tell their side of the story to the legal authority. Second, being treated with dignity and respect and concern for rights. Third, being able to ascertain when legal decisions are fair. That is, decisions need to be carried out with transparency. They need to be grounded in fact, and they need to be neutral. And finally, when coming to conclusions about the fairness of legal authorities, what people really care about is being able to ascertain whether the motives of the legal authority they're dealing with is those motives are benevolent and well-intentioned. We call that motive-based trust. And a key factor in being able to figure out whether someone's motives are good is the extent to which people are willing to acknowledge when they have made mistakes or engaged in wrongdoing in the past. And I think that's one of the primary concerns about what's going on right now, is that we see again and again instances in which, at best, mistakes were made, and more likely and at worst, serious wrongdoing has occurred, and there is a persistent inability or refusal to acknowledge it as such. I think commitment to these principles will change the way policing agencies carry out their tasks. And because of that, the President's task force in which I sat built our 59 recommendations around this key idea. The first pillar was called Building Trust and Legitimacy. All things, sorts of things follow from that, policy, training, and so forth. So I think I will stop there, because I think we have a kind of overall framework and some ideas about policy. And Tammy has given us an extremely great tutorial about constitutional law. My train is about to pull into Metro Park, so I'm going to listen for a bit and then join back in when we talk about questions. Thanks a lot, everybody.
Thank you to both of you. And Professor Chavis, I want to give you an opportunity to sort of respond to some of the things that Professor Mears raised, and also to talk, as you mentioned in your earlier remarks, about the role of police body-worn cameras and just sort of like general surveillance in this discussion.
Yes, yes. So first of all, the task force, the 21st Century Task Force report, is a wonderful report and document, in that many of us on this call may remember, may have even given some testimony at some point, but just a collection from a large body, widespread body of views on policing and reform and legitimacy, and what can communities do in terms of making sure that their police forces are operating in a more democratic and fair way. And so I think that my advice to, and I have often given this advice to, you know, police chiefs, thinking, well, this is, you know, a federal document, national best practices type thing, and how do I make it relevant for my local community? But I think that every police chief in America should look at that and should be thinking about which of these 59 recommendations can I easily implement within my department? Which ones are we doing? Which ones can we implement? And which ones do we need help implementing? What do we need? If we need more funding for something, what can we do? So I just think that it's a good start, because a lot of times we want to think about particular police departments, large municipal police departments, New York, Miami, Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., but we're forgetting that there are over 18,000 law enforcement agencies in the United States, many of whom don't have a great deal of resources or technical assistance, and So this document is very, very helpful. I think that one of the things that we're thinking about, and is mentioned, one of the reforms is de-escalation and thinking about, as Professor Muir said, why is it that we have, first of all, some of the initial contacts with law enforcement that we have, and from my point of view, it's the question that I ask is why are communities of color policed in such a different and aggressive manner? Things that are happening in some communities would not be tolerated elsewhere. And a very good counterargument, some people say to that, well, some of these communities are the most ravaged by crime and they need a heavy hand and that type of thing. But in talking and in some of my research, in talking with members of communities, they absolutely want the security that Professor Mears talked about and really want less of this policing these low-level infractions, which often do lead to encounters with police officers that can turn violent. So there's that. I would also say that one reform that we need to think about is, and I'll just give a few statistics. I meant to begin with these, but the Washington Post reports that in 2016, 708 people have been shot by police officers. Another study called The Counted, which I think is published by The Guardian, says that this number is about 795, 796, 64 people in the month of September alone, September 2016 alone. And when we're thinking about this, the number of folks that are shot or killed by police officers, the Post also reports that there have only been 54 officers who've been criminally charged after they've shot and killed someone in the line of duty. So when we think back to the legitimacy and the things that Professor Mears was talking about, there's a lack of, I think what many citizens see is a lack of accountability. And finally, I guess I would say that we don't have currently a national database that even gives us reliable data. We've had to rely on, we don't have a government entity that gives us this data. And just think how wonderful a national database would be. There are plans and I think funding and a new law in place to have that, but could give us so much information about when these uses of force occur. What types of, if we can study this, what types of officers are engaging in force? Are there police forces that have really low levels of uses of force? What is it they're doing, and how are they training their officers? And so that could be incredibly helpful. Another one of the things that the task force report mentioned was this use of technology, including body cameras. And I'll just say briefly here that body cameras are, I'm a proponent of police officers having body cameras. There are some very limited studies. We need more information on this, but there are some limited studies that suggest that both police officers and citizens conduct themselves differently when these cameras are in use. And there have been some jurisdictions that have seen lower reports of officer complaints and lower uses of force when we have these cameras. But again, I want to come back to this theme of legitimacy and accountability, because in North Carolina and in several states, in North Carolina, a law will go into effect October 1st that's going to exempt these body camera footage from the public records statute. And so it's going to be incredibly difficult and restrictive to have any of that footage be released to the public. I do not believe that body camera footage should be, that any and all body camera footage should be available publicly at all times. I do not believe that even when we have a shooting such as this, that the body camera footage should be made available instantaneously. However, I do think that it should be made available to the public quickly and swiftly once it can be determined that there hasn't been, that there won't be any damage to the integrity of the possible prosecution of an officer who's used this. That sometimes takes a matter of days. It does not take 90 days or some of these lengthy periods that we've seen in some of the state laws, and at least in North Carolina, really indefinitely, unless you get a court order, that this footage would not be released. And so those types of laws are at odds with this notion of this big push that we've had in the first place to have them, and that is so that we can have more transparency. And it's one of those tenets that Tracy mentioned.
Great. Thank you so much. Operator, I think that we probably can now open up the queue for questions.
The lines are now open for questions. If you would like to do so or ask a question, you can press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Our first question comes from David Lillehog. Your line is live. David?
Yes, forgive me. I'd like to ask the panelists whether there are any efforts underway to determine whether there might be state constitutional remedies. In other words, whether the Terry versus Ohio reasonable articulable suspicion standard is really tough enough, and whether maybe reconsidering that at the state constitutional level might be appropriate.
Well, Professor Chavis, do you want that? Or I have a few comments on that. When you talk about whether Terry versus Ohio is strict enough, one of the things that I think people overlook is the fact that Terry versus Ohio is not really about the stop at all. It's about the frisk. And that's actually part of the essence of the issue. In other words, in discussing whether the stop was okay, what the court was really getting at was whether the evidence that was produced from the frisk should be admitted. So the key finding in Terry was whether that frisk was okay, and the court said two things. First of all, that they thought that the officer McFadden had reasonable suspicion to believe that that Terry was armed and dangerous, right? Because he suspected him of committing a robbery. Justice Harlan was worried, actually, about the extent to which frisk would naturally and automatically follow from a stop. But that actually didn't come up in Terry. What Terry didn't do was actually address the force of a stop, as you suggested, and that came in later cases. I think that there is an opportunity in state constitutional law to at least interpret that standard with more stringency, as the Massachusetts Supreme Court recently did, by saying that it could, in fact, be reasonable for someone to run away from police, in a decision that is different from the Supreme Court decision in a similar case. So I think there's certainly a possibility, although state courts have not been very inclined to take up Justice Brennan's call to do that.
Yeah,
Go ahead.
You could take another question.
Our next question comes from Dan Roth. Your line is live.
Thanks. Professor Mears, did the task force that you served on consider or propose any changes to Section 1983, particularly with respect to pushing back against the Supreme Court's qualified immunity holdings, which have really raised the bar in terms of civil accountability?
No, we didn't. Most of our recommendations were directed at recommendations we could give to the president, so the federal government, for strengthening policing agencies at the state and local level. So you, if you read through the recommendations, you'll notice that most of them say things like should, consider, things like that. Because as Professor Chavis mentioned, 18,000 agencies, the action is really going to be happening at the local and state level. And I think we concluded that actual federal enforcement, while important for establishing baselines, we have a Department of Civil Rights that has been more active in this area than it ever has been with its active pursuit of Section 14141 consent decrees. We felt that we really ought to go to where the rubber meets the road, which is by encouraging departments and states to adopt their own policies, that would be much more effective. And one more note on federal involvement. Many people say a really good idea is to make federal funding to the state and locals conditional on their compliance with certain kinds of best practices. Again, pointing out what Professor Chavis said, among the 18,000 agencies across the nation, fewer than half of them actually receive any federal funding at all. So this is not a very hearty carrot or stick, or however you want to think about using federal funding to get this work done.
Professor Chavis, did you have any comments on 1983 liability and qualified immunity that you wanted to share?
Well, I think that only just to say when we're looking at, you know, the Section 1983 cases and kind of trying to jump over that hurdle of qualified immunity, we have to go back to this whether or not the officer was acting objectively reasonable. And so that's why I think that these standards, you know, they although I struggle to think about what would be a better standard, but I feel that the legal standards, they're not always touching, or they're not always, we don't always see a great deal of justice, I think, in some of these situations when a person has lost their life, but the officer mistakenly believed that he was carrying. You know, there have been cases where there's one case, some folks in Philadelphia may remember the, I think it seems, Abebe Isaac incident. This is a case of someone, you know, firing shots into the air at midnight on New Year's, and an officer sees him. Someone flees into a row home, and the officer opens fire in the residence, and bullets from that officer's gun struck Mr. Isaac, who was not the man who had shot fired the shots. He was not the person. And the district attorney's office cleared that in 2010, cleared that officer of criminal charges, saying that his actions were justified. So when you see cases like that, and you have this, and they're kind of based on this legal standard, and a prosecutor you've asked about Section 1983 cases with which, again, kind of the same standard here, though, but in the case of whether or not to prosecute that officer, you know, the district attorney's got to think about, well, am I going to be able to meet my burden? And so that's why I think the legal standards are problematic and don't offer us the assistance that they could.
If I could take the moderator's prerogative to just follow up on that very quickly. You mentioned sort of with Graham, its sort of inability to deal with implicit bias. And I guess I'd like to ask you both sort of how you feel that plays into this and whether it's something that needs to be addressed at the front end, or if it can even be addressed in the back end after a shooting or a use of force that may be the result of implicit bias, whether there's any sort of remedy for that, or if it absolutely has to be addressed in terms of training.
Cami. I think it's a very complicated issue. I think it does need to be addressed. I wish that, you know, if there's a way to figure out how can we work this into the doctrine. We've seen those cases. There's also a case where I think it's a Fourth Circuit case, and it may be even in the dissent, but one of the justices says this concept of, oh, you made a furtive movement, so that's going to give reasonable suspicion for the officer to stop you. And the judge in that case really kind of took to task the officers, saying furtive movement. You're just using that, and there's some implicit bias perhaps going on. I think that one of the best ways we can address that is in who we through training perhaps, but also who we hire. We're asking officers today to do a lot of different things than they were asked to do 20, 30 years ago, and so we have to be very careful, not just thinking about implicit bias, but a particular applicant's proclivity to violence, or their ability to connect with a community and to problem solve. So it has to be, I think, a more holistic approach. But really, what we're talking about is an entire shift in the paradigm of policing and in the culture surrounding it, again, with the aggressiveness which some of these tactics are used.
So just to add on to what Professor Chavis was saying, as the faculty director of the Justice Collaboratory, I'm working on a project with the Center for Policing Equity, which is headed up by Phil Goff, now at John Jay University, and also the National Network for Safe Communities, also at John Jay University. We are involved in a project called Building Trust in Justice and Communities. We've got 6 pilot sites, and one of our key pillars, so to speak, is about, touches on implicit bias, but Phil, who is a psychologist, would characterize the issue more broadly, and he would talk about it as the relevance of the mind sciences to creating identity traps that are problematic for officers. And so when you take a look at that, you understand that while implicit bias is the thing that we're all talking about and it does matter, there are a lot of other identity issues and social psychology that are perhaps even more powerful, and they work together. So another one is, if you think about the work of the psychologist Claude Steele out in California, he talks a lot about the ways in which different kinds of identity threats form the ways in which people respond to different contexts. So what happens in policing is, as Professor Chavis said, police are asked to do a lot of things all at once, often under time pressure. And it is in those contexts in which these identity threats are triggered and often cause problems for police in terms of their behavior. And so while we can't do a great deal about affecting our biases, we all have them, they're structural, they're a function of the world in which we live and the history that the world has given us. What we can do is make people both more aware of them, and we can change the contexts in which people operate. And that means if we actually change the nature of the job that police are doing, then we're going to be less likely to be in a situation in which identity threats pose problems for police interactions with the public. Therefore, let's make it less likely that people are in situations in which escalation is present such that use of force takes place. Or let's try to figure out a world in which guns are less prevalent. So maybe we should be thinking about investments in gun sense policy that will make it less likely for police to claim the danger imperative when they're in an interaction with a member of the public, such that these different kinds of identity threats are triggered. It turns out that a lot of good policy that doesn't on its face seem to have that much to do with good policing actually does have to do with good police.
I think we're ready for our next question, operator.
Our next question comes from James Williams, Jr. Your line is live.
Thank you, and I have a brief comment and a question there. There's a paper by Devon Carbato of the UCLA School of Law that is on this very subject, blue on black violence, and he speaks to structural conditions that has led to the increased use of force, including deadly force, involving black people, and some of the very things that we've talked about he addresses. One of the questions that I have, let's say some of the recommendations for reform that have been referred to includes the decreased use of sort of regulatory stops by police and the decreased use or elimination of broken windows policing and things of that nature. I wonder if there have been any studies done that have attempted to track the use of force or decreased use of force with any of these type reforms.
So the idea is that, as I understand the question that you're asking, you know, can we actually correlate changes in certain modes of policing with decreases in use of force? I think a lot of that work is ongoing. I mean, here's what we do know about things like broken windows policing. We know that enforcement of broken windows policing as it was carried out in New York City, which technically, if you know anything about the theory of broken windows policing, couldn't really legitimately be called broken windows policing, but
right.
we'll leave that aside for the moment.
Right.
We know that when police engage in that kind of policing, that there is a direct relationship between that and lower perceptions of legitimacy. The best work on that is done by my colleague Tom Tyler and his co-authors Jeff Fagan and Amanda Geller. The paper is called Teachable Moments. That we know. We also know that when police engage in those kinds of encounters, there are many more encounters, so it's natural to think that the risk of deadly force is enhanced, although I'm not aware of any particular study that has examined exactly that question. A lot of the people who do work on use of force, I'm thinking like Bill Terrell and David Klinger, they're criminologists. David Klinger is at the University of Missouri, St. Louis, I think, somewhere in Missouri.
Yeah.
I'm not sure where Bill Terrell is anymore. They tend to look much more at individual circumstances as opposed to connecting particular policies or demographics. The relationship between particular demographic characteristics of officers and the likelihood or not of using force, right? So do more educated officers, are they less likely to use force? Are women less likely to use lethal force? Things like that. But I'm not familiar with very particular research that connects the policies themselves to lethal force. Professor Chavis, maybe.
Yes, I'm not familiar with studies on that particular issue, but I think what I would say in response is that, again, this kind of gives us the necessity, right, or the rationale for having more information collected. These recent uses of force that we're seeing over the past, 2 years has been a lot of attention, but this has been happening in many communities for many years, and we can think about some of the reasons that we are perhaps more focused on it as a nation right now. But what I would say is that we really have to get more credible evidence. We really have to begin to collect this information. And once again, I go back to transparency in terms of when this information is collected, will those municipalities or jurisdictions make it public, and then able for criminologists or other folks to study this and study some of these links that you've talked about.
Okay, I think we're ready for our next question, operator.
I have no further questions in queue at this time.
Okay. With that, then, I guess I would like to thank both Professor Chavis and Professor Mears for, I think, what was a wonderful presentation, and everyone else for joining the call. A reminder that CLE credit is available, and we'll send the information in a follow-up email for claiming that credit, as well as some materials that were discussed during today's call. I'd also shamelessly plug an upcoming report by ACS called What's the Big Idea? Recommendations for Improving Law and Policy in the Next Administration, which includes a fantastic piece by Professor Mears examining three proposals for reforming policing. And also later this year, keep an eye out for Professor Chavis's ACS issue brief on police use of force. And with that, I'd like to again thank everyone and have a good afternoon.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
This concludes today's teleconference. You may now disconnect your lines.